Welcome to the Just Fly Performance Podcast, episode 47. Today on the show, I'll be answering listener questions on speed, strength, jumping, plyometrics, biomechanics, and a whole lot more. Today's episode is brought to you by Simply Faster. Simply Faster is an online athletic performance technology shop distributing items such as the FreeLap timing system, GymAware, K-Box, 1080 Sprint, and the SpeedMat. I've gotten many of these items from Simply Faster and can confidently say that they make today's best training technology available to everybody. The FreeLap timing system has revolutionized both my practices and my athlete assessments, allowing me to look at the 10-meter fly capability of dozens of athletes in a matter of seconds. It is wireless, compact, portable, and incredibly versatile. The K-Box and 1080 Sprint are fantastic tools for any coach looking to build speed, agility, and implement training scenarios that go beyond the traditional weight room. The 1080 Sprint is being used by great coaches training some of the fastest sprinters in the world, and it truly represents high-performance speed training. I can personally attest that Simply Faster's customer service is second to none. Christopher at Simply Faster responds quickly to queries, and anyone who makes a purchase from Simply Faster is in good hands. If you want to acquire some of the best high-tech training equipment available, stop by simplyfaster.com. That's simply with an I, faster.com. They are the future of coaching technology. All right, welcome to episode 47 of the podcast. I'm your host, Joel Smith, and today I am answering a variety of questions that the listeners gave back to me after I threw out the call on social media yesterday. Every now and then, between guests or arranging guests, and I have some great ones lined up for you all over the course of the next 3, 4, 5 weeks. Really excited for that, but it's always good to sit back and take some questions, and these answers, the answers that I give, it's always a time of reflection for me in a way, just because sometimes you have to almost, I think as coaches, sometimes it's important to, if not talk out, to sit down and write down, what do you think about training? What do you think about training your own athlete populations? Can you put it on a piece of paper and say, this is what I believe, this is what I think works, and move from there? I think that's something that, I think it was Stuart McMillan who I originally heard that from, and I just think it's a great idea. I think it's good to reflect. And I love taking on questions and seeing what you all got. So to those of you who answered the questions that I, or the call for questions, I appreciate it. Thank you for those who put some out there on Facebook to make me feel better. Last time I barely got any answers there. They were almost all on Instagram. I guess Instagram's where all the cool kids hang out these days and seem to operate. So thanks for those. I would like it if I got through all of them today. I think we got, I can count them up here, but at least I think 15 questions, 12 to 15, if not more. So I'm gonna have to move quick. I found last time I did this that, well, I already knew this, and I'll tell you what, my wife really knows this, but I tend to be a little bit long-winded, and so yeah, I'm gonna try to get through these and be concise to get as much of them as I can. And you know what, if I don't, we'll do another one of these and we'll kind of finish it out. So thanks for tuning in today. So let's get on to the questions, okay? First, and these are in no particular order. I don't have them really arranged by category. We're just going from the top. And first off, we have in the world of just general training, Moon Kim 713 says, what do you think about Marv Marinovich's training? I'm assuming training program, philosophy, or what have you. And I'm glad you asked that question, Moon Kim. And just because it's a type of training that isn't often talked about, or, I mean, it falls under the gimmicky approach for many of us, or what many of us would consider gimmicky. But so Marv Marinovich, for those of you who don't know, famous trainer, if you remember the proprioceptors and jump soles, he did a video for the proprioceptors back in the day. The proprioceptor was like, it was this little plug that you put in the bottom of the jump sole. So you had this block on the ball of your foot, and then you have this little like circular plug that goes on it that causes a little like instability that you can rotate around the axis for extra ankle strength and those types of things, which honestly, I've been just lately, this is a little bit random, but been watching some dunkers, dunk contests from a real, maybe a state of more awareness than I used to watch them, knowing what's going on more from gait and what joint by joint analysis. And you'll see that a a lot of these dunkers, when they plant, their ankles really, they really get in this big, this serious eversion. Like, these guys have a lot of strength in ankle eversion, which is the ankle turning towards the little toe side. And you have to be strong to have that mobility, because athletes, the brain will not let you get to that place unless it knows those muscles are strong enough to hold it and then come back from it. So yeah, I think there might be something to that, a little plug in the bottom of the shoe. I'm not saying it's magic, but I think it's kind of cool. Anyways, there's a lot of other ways to do that stuff too. Like, there's Russian slant boards. You go on my YouTube and look up a few years back. I have some of my high jumpers training on this. Well, one in particular, but training on this slant board where you jump on angled board side to side. It does train you strength in that eversion. Which high jump, that's pretty darn important too. But high jump dunking, yeah, your ankle's got, we don't operate in the sagittal plane. We operate in three planes. So the best athletes can do that stuff. Anyway, sorry, I'm going on a tangent here, but Marvin Marinovich is training. So outside of that, you watch like the DVD or you see some of his things. And I actually had his book back in the day. I bought it between my junior and senior years of college. And it was called a ProBod X. That's spelled ProBod and then the letter X. And I don't have the book anymore because, and this has probably happened, any of you who have like a lot of books, this has probably happened to, but I gave it away, or I didn't give it away. I lent it to a trainer who was at the personal training gym I was interning at, and I never got it back. So sad, maybe I'll have to buy it again. But the book was very much so based on instability training, all the things we would call gimmicky today, stuff on Bosu balls and all this. And the premise, it was actually the first time that I had ever really heard of the idea of, you know, training the little muscles. So otherwise, the big muscles will do all the work, and then the little muscles will get small and not do anything. It actually is a good concept. And so it was the summer between my junior and senior year. I had just come off a year where I had set a 4-inch high jump PR and done a lot of good standard weight training, mostly just half squats, 2/3 squats type things, and step ups and that type of deal. Not a whole lot of Olympic lifting, but for the summer I was working moving. That was my summer job, but I also started doing some of this ProBod X Marv Marinovich style training. And I wasn't standing on the Bosu ball or the physio ball. I remember the three exercises I kind of got from that. Well, at least say two. Maybe I can come up with three, but it was a rear foot elevated split squat with the rear leg on a physio ball. And I think I had some sort of water jugs. That was my resistance. I may have held it overhead. I'm not 100% sure. Also, I was doing pistol squats, so just regular pistols. I don't remember with weight or not. And there may have been one other type of exercise with a similar level of instability that I was using. But what I noticed as I started to progress through that training a little bit was that my 2-foot jump just kind of seemed to really, really boost. It really kind of exploded. I mean, I didn't gain like 6 or 8 inches, but yeah, at least a solid 2 to 4 inch gain in my 2-leg jump. I had a good season of high jumping off one leg, but big 2-leg jumping gain from no real like heavy weight training and doing this kind of single leg, more instability based stuff. And so I was like, oh man, this stuff is so awesome. Oh, I do remember the third one. It was back to the wall, or not the wall, but you put a physio ball on the wall, put your back on the physio ball and do single leg squats. So your foot is obviously stable on the ground, but the instability exists around like the spine and the hip and those things. So it's instability, but it's not like stupid instability. I mean, there is some specific element because your foot is planted, and well, really you look at stance or gait, and it is, you are technically kind of balancing on a stable surface as your swing leg passes over. I'm not saying that balance training is awesome and amazing and we all need to do it in copious amounts, but I'm just saying don't discount something just because you put it in the gimmicky bin because it has a physio ball. That's all I'm saying. Anyways, so I did that and I really liked the effect I got of it. But I think going back into the next year of training and whatnot, and going through the years, I think what I kind of came to a consensus on was that as a primary mode of training, it's not something you would want to do all the time. It's not enough weight to overload. some aspects of the system. But what it does really well is it helps, and I'm a fan of Chris Corfus and the Gate guys, and I've learned this from them, is I think it really helps athletes to stabilize the tripod of the foot and strengthen the motion of the leg, the motions and muscles of the leg in context of balancing on that tripod or the heel, the ball, the little toe, and the ball, the big toe. And if you can do that well, and you'll get a good benefit from it, you're going to be able to wire more power into your muscles, and it's helpful, and you're not loading the spine up. So I like contrasting it with periods of stuff where you're doing heavy barbell training, normal stuff, go deload weeks or transition periods or summer training or whatever. I think there's a good time and place for those types of things. I don't remember a lot of the other stuff from the book, not enough that it stuck with me for sure, but I do think that it can get results, and I think it can keep athletes healthy. But again, if you want the highest overload, you're going to have to use heavier actual weights. So yeah, decent stuff, interesting stuff. The book's Probot X. You want to check it out, go for it. Yeah, that's about all I have to say about that.
You're listening to the Just Fly Performance Podcast, brought to you by Simply Faster.
Okay, next question from GIO 6398. Thank you for your question. And it is a 1.5 bodyweight squat and 1.75 deadlift enough for a 37-inch running vert? This is a very specific question. It might be the most specific question of the day. I'm assuming, Geo 6398, that you do in fact have a 1.5 bodyweight squat and 1.75 deadlift, and now want to know how high you can jump with that. So, I mean, fair question, understandable. I think that with the at least the where we are in this trend in human performance, there is this thing that's like you should lift this much to jump this high. But you know what? There's guys who have been well under those numbers who have jumped well over 37 inches. I will tell you that. I know that there's also people who have been way over those numbers that couldn't even come close to jumping 37 inches. So it just depends on a lot of things. It depends on how your body is built. And you know, anatomy and muscle insertions and lengths and twitch types and propensity for strength and all that stuff. So there's not an exact equation. I'm sorry about that. I don't know if it's like a trick question because you like wanted me to say yes or no, and then you already had jumped 37 and you're like, I gotcha. I heard somewhere too, I think, I don't know if this was Brett Contreras or what, but Kenny Dobbs, big time dunker, I want to say, and this is a guy who get his head over the rim at, I don't know, 6'2", like only squat like 115. I'm sure obviously if he trained for it, he could squat way more. But again, the strength is important. Generally speaking, stronger athletes will jump higher and probably will run faster. They will. I mean, the strongest athletes jump higher and run faster. But the question is, and always is, if you listen to my other shows, especially stuff like Angus Ross, or which that one was awesome, but it's like, the question is, how do you get to that place? How did you get to that double bodyweight squat? Did you do it squatting once a week and just kind of playing around in the weight room, which is cool, more power to you if that was you were able to do that? Or I shouldn't say playing around, but did you not have to strain to get there? Or did you have to do whatever powerlifting program and be in the weight room 3-4 times a week to crank that out? If you had to strain to get there, it's probably not going to have had the best benefit on your athleticism. Okay, I feel like I'm rabbit trailing. I'm bouncing around the question, and I can't stand it when other people bounce around the question. So here's my answer. Yes, it's enough for a 37-inch running vert if you are built elastically and plyometrics is your jam and you have that type of static spring. If you don't, if you're more of a strength-type athlete and you are at those numbers, no, it's probably not enough for a 37-inch. I would say on average, it's not enough. But again, keep everything in perspective. Don't think, okay, I'm too weak and I need to get stronger and I'm just going to spend all my time in the weight room and then I'm going to get to my... No, it's keep a balanced approach. Remember the principles of easy strength, Dan John, Pavel Satsaline, one of my favorite books, and always leave something in the tank in your lifts. Don't be in the weight room more than you have to be. Weight room is complimentary. It should be like 10% of the total program. If you want to jump higher, jumping is a massive proportion, or playing basketball or your sport or different types of plyos, that's the massive proportion. And weightlifting, you do want your strength to go up, absolutely. I would say most people that have a 37-inch running vert And the big difference, I forgot, off one or two. Oh man, there's people who can jump 37 inches off one whose squat is garbage. And but off of 2 feet, yeah, it's more specific to squatting and deadlifting itself, and those people are going to have higher lifts. So if you're a 1 foot jumper, yeah, I don't know, maybe. If you're a 2 foot jumper, yeah, you probably need to get your lifts up a little bit, but don't like do tons of powerlifting work to get there. Do athletic balance based stuff, and hopefully you will be on the promised land towards a higher jump. I can tell you, at least, let's see, digging into what I did, and then my best 2 foot jump, since it's the most specific, we'll say, is about 39 over the years when I did that. Oh, let's see, squat might have been like 1.8. And deadlift maybe 1.9. Yeah, squat maybe 1.75, deadlift 1.8, 1.9. That's about what I was looking at. Actually, it might have been worse than that. Basically, squatting about 320 at 185, 190, whatever that is. It's not very good. I was never the strongest guy in the squat rack. And every time I tried really, really hard to squat more, I didn't jump super high, especially off one leg. Jumped terrible off one leg. So just let it happen. It'll come together. And yeah, so that's kind of what I have to say there. Okay, next one. Sorry, taking a lot of time. We have one from on my text size on this computer screen. I'm having a kind of a hard time reading this, but from, I will just say, Darko, does bounding really increase single leg jumping? My answer is yes, it does increase single leg jumping. If you're an elite person, advanced or elite, improving your bound may not improve your single leg jump that much. But on the novice intermediate levels, even advanced, yeah, your bounding marks tie in really well with your single leg jump marks. I remember, I don't know who told me this. Oh, excuse me. I think it was a Russian high jump coach, and it was about a Russian jumper. I don't know why his name is escaping me, but he jumped 7'11" back in the 80s, and he was like 6 feet tall. And I think it was him or this other coach, and it told me, I think his bounding, his five bounds, I think he got a small run in, but he could bound like 80 feet on five bounds. And that's like, what is that? That's like a 55 foot triple jump. And then you're going 25 more feet on your last, actually, no, probably like a 50 foot triple jump. And then you're going 15 more on your last two. That's pretty ridiculous. I mean, 80 feet. So these guys who are up there, these guys who are getting up off one leg, they can bound far. But at the same time, if all you do is bounding and you're a high jumper or you're trying to dunk and you don't ever do anything vertical, and it's probably going to hurt you. Just that rhythm and being able to take things up, like straight up, isn't so good. You can probably take things up and out like Mike Conley did in the dunk contest. Whatever dunk contest it was, it wasn't the NBA one, but whatever one he did, Mike Conley Sr., that is, when he dunked like behind the free throw line, he could take it up and out. I've heard of just bounding messing up high jumpers if you only bound or only train with triple jumpers, but no, bounding is a marker of your elasticity. It's a marker of your biarticular leg muscles, the rectus femoris and hamstrings to work as far as energy transport ability is concerned, which is things you really need for single leg jumping. If you don't have that, it's going to be really hard to get up off one leg well, and probably two legs too, but especially one. And you're going to get good benefits just from like tendon stiffness, ankle stiffness. You're going to get the concentric kind of portion from the glutes and hamstrings and calves. The only thing you're really missing is the eccentric loading of the quad and then the final direction of the jump. But yeah, no, it's awesome. Okay. Do things like Nordic hamstring, also for, question from same writer, do things like Nordic hamstring curls have an effect as well on single leg jumping? I would say not that much. It's Nordic hamstring curls are more the hamstring, strengthening the hamstring in respect to knee flexion, which is more of a sprinting thing because that's when the greatest forces in sprinting are in that shin coming forward. I think some general hamstring strength is fine for single leg jumping. It's important. It's important. It acts in like an explosive isometric manner. And although the Nordic hamstring might not be really like it, there's not a whole lot in the weight room I think you can really do to replicate what the hamstring does in single leg jumping. Maybe like explosive stuff off the glute ham off one leg or whatever. But I think just doing a lot of the main lifts, Olympic lifts, and those types of things will give you adequate hamstring development, and sprinting, of course. Yeah, sprinting is pretty good for your hamstrings, last I heard. So, and yeah, bounding and that. Bounding's good too for explosive hamstrings that you would see in jumping, single leg jumping. And it's just single leg jumping is so elastic. There's not a whole lot in the weight room that helps from an elasticity standpoint. So, I mean, it's a good general exercise, and we'll just leave it at that. It's going to help with basic strength, basic eccentric strength, but it's definitely not a specific exercise. Okay, moving on. So someone asked me another name that I'd have to literally spell the whole thing out, and I would totally butcher it, so I'm really sorry. But the question was, what do you think about functional patterns training for basketball players? Okay, so functional patterns training. I had to actually clarify and ask on this, on what is this thing? So I looked it up on the old YouTube. I think it was YouTube or Google, whatever. I ended up on YouTube, and I was like, oh, yeah, I've seen this guy before. So functional patterns, basically just one of those guys who plays around with kettlebells and medicine balls in a unique way that catches people's eye. And, it's not specific training. It's all general training. And of course, it is very, very gimmicky looking. So most of us who are experienced coaches are obviously going to just throw it all out. But I do believe there's truth in anything, like in any training method, there is some element of truth I can take from at least someone who's passionate about what they do, because this guy is clearly pretty passionate about what he does. And it's stuff like a lot of like MMA style stuff, a lot of stuff in the transverse plane. So rotational type movement. A lot of cross crawl based movement using cables and medicine balls and kettlebells and those types of things, and that's good. That stuff is great. It's not your primary method. Maybe what you're asking is, should it be my primary method in the weight room? And then with basketball, well, it's the weight room is not what's going to make you a great basketball player. Your specific training on the court is what is going to make you a great basketball player. But in terms of being supportive, it depends. Again, with everything, there's not one training style that works well for everybody. Where I would put that type of training primarily, and this kind of going with the vibe of what I wrote about with my buddy Paul Cater, is I'd put that stuff in the warm-up. Because, well, what do you want a warm-up to do? If we would even call it the warm-up, I mean, at least the way Paul does it, is it's an important, the warm-up being an important non-quantified, in terms of the weight you're using on the bar or whatever, a portion of the workout designed to kind of repattern and engage the body and prepare it for the small, quantified, or actual weightlifting part of the workout. So all this stuff with the kettlebells and the single arm kettlebells and the chops and the medicine ball throws and the rotational stuff, I think that stuff goes really well as part of the warm-up, especially if it's fun and fast-paced and new. The nervous system gets a huge charge out of that stuff. And I mean, you see a little bit of it in like Cal Dietz, what Cal Dietz and Matt Van Dyke are doing with like the 3D contralateral type stuff. I think that's something that is in Cal's. I think it's in Cal's books. But yeah, like doing things in the warm up that connect the right hip with the left shoulder and vice versa. That connect the reflexive and cross crawl patterning of the body. So that when you get to the lifting stuff, your body's in a good state. And I mean, gait, or the way we walk, reciprocates really in almost everything. And we don't exist in a bilateral sagittal plane environment. So I don't think the majority of the training we do in the weight room should exist in a bilateral sagittal plane environment. I think some of it should, especially basketball. You need to do what you can do and what's going to make you better. There's no one lift that everybody absolutely should do. And it's not like track and field where there's these special strength lifts that do tend to really help. It's all about staying healthy and good patterning for maximal injury resiliency and specific explosiveness. So, yeah, I think all that stuff is great in the warm-up. Okay, cool. Next question.
You're listening to the Just Fly Performance Podcast, brought to you by Simply Faster.
We got from Jake Tura, that's Tuura. So thanks for the question, Jake. Practical methods for vision training for team sport athletes. Cool. So question A, well, thank you for this one. So I'm not the man to ask this question to. I do some of this stuff. The man is people like Jeff Moyer or Dr. Harrison at Slow the Game Down. And so I actually gave Jeff a call when I got this question because I'm like, hey, man, I got this question. I'm not the man at this stuff. I do a little bit, but I know you know a lot more about this than I do. And so Jeff had mentioned a few things, and I do a few of these. So the two like really simple, practical stuff that I can like describe that doesn't require any advanced training at all is just simple stuff like saccades and pursuits. So what's a saccade? Well, mechanical integrity of your eye or ability, the mechanical ability of your eye is an important factor in athletic performance. So the ability of your eyeball to turn and move your eye in the correct direction and as well as to a response. So a saccade would be, say, put your two thumbs in front of you and just rapidly switch your focus of your eyes between one thumb and the next, and then slowly spread your thumbs apart, taking your arms out to the side. And as you're doing that, still switch your eyes from one thumb to the other and take those thumbs out to the periphery. See how far you can go. See how good your peripheral vision is and how your eye's ability is there. So just the ability to switch focus is a good one. Pursuits is another one as well. So that would be like taking a pen or pencil and having your focus on the tip and taking it out in front of you in different directions, like a figure eight. An easy way would be you do it. A harder way would be like a teammate or a coach would do it. So those are two really easy ways. And you'll find, especially in stuff like pursuits, if you're a coach, you can like check for kind of weird, funky stuff. Like sometimes an athlete won't like a particular area, like the transition from, say, when the pen is at the bottom left coming up towards the middle. An athlete might, their eyes might kind of skip or not really like that position. So it just gives you an idea of where you might need to work or want to work more. You can also do stuff. Jeff has told me some really, really cool drills. You can do like an elevation drill. So it's kind of finding a perception space. So depth perception space and focus and space and prediction. So you might say, hey, that doorknob that's across the room, tell me where on your body you think that's going to hit if you were to walk into it. You know, maybe it's going to hit you in the belly button or the chest or something. And so then you actually walk over to it. And well, what do you know? It did hit me in the belly button, I guess, right with how high that was off the ground. So just the ability to predict things in space. You can do things based off of soft and hard focuses. So you could what you call like perturbation drills. So where you're like moving side to side and a teammate's right across from you, and you have to move side to side and keep a focus on a part of their face, like their mouth. And so you have to keep this hard focus despite moving. So the ability to focus while on the move. Well, a soft focus would be focusing on something. Well, you're focusing on their mouth, being able to perceive things in the background. So can you perceive these things even when your focus is narrow? And I think that's cool too. I think that almost goes into like the sympathetic parasympathetic paradigm too. Not being so narrowly focused that you miss out on everything. I think that's what I was terrible at when I played basketball. I think when I would get in trouble is when I would be so narrowly focused I couldn't see anything else. And that's why I probably wasn't a very good basketball player. I mean, I was okay, but I wasn't like all state or anything. Or well, I wasn't even first team all conference. So yes, I was not the greatest player because I let my sympathetic system get the better of me, but I think it helped me in track and field from time to time. Anyways, so those are those are some cool drills, and I think that Jeff's the guy to talk to, or Dr. Harrison, Slow the Game Down. Those guys are doing cool things, and Jeff is working on a chapter for Jay DeMeo's book. I believe it's going to be The Manual, Volume 2. So be sure to check that out. Jay does a great job with that stuff, and Jeff's work is first class. So you definitely will not be disappointed by go ahead and investing in that if you're interested in vision training. A question on the other end, the spectrum a little bit outside of vision is also from Jake. Practical methods for training a velocity deficient athlete to increase power at their body weight load. So what I'm guessing here is if you did like a test on like the Just Jump app and you were velocity deficient, you had force and you're trying to improve power. The two things, the main things that JB was doing, I think the one main thing that I can remember was overspeed jumping on like a sled type system. So like a power shuttle. I can't remember the exact name, but or pro shuttle, the sliding cart basically that allows you to push off extra hard. You could also do assisted jumping. So jumping from with band suspended around your waist, or you could do the cheap way and put them through your armpits, which that works too. So if you're lacking velocity, that stuff is really good. I also think med balls are cool too. So like light med balls, people like to think of med balls in the sense of what med ball is going to give me like a really high power output. And but I think we don't spend enough time throwing really light stuff like 6 pound balls, 8 pound balls. Spending time with my buddy Paul Cater down at his gym in Monterey, he likes warming up with just chucking a basketball as fast as you can. Or at least that's what we did that day. Just chucked a basketball at each other as fast as we could. And it was fun. We don't get to super, super high speed that often in our training. And well, granted, a lot of us need force, but I think it's good to expose yourself to high speed as well. Okay, a few more questions here. So we got Strong by Science. Thank you for the questions, and I really appreciate it, man. And so these are some good ones. I'm excited to answer these. So Strong by Science says, what is the one aspect of the education system you would change to help make schooling more applicable, applicable, and in parentheses, decreasing the divide between science and application? Well, this is a huge question, and I mean that in a few ways. One is that I think it's really important and really relevant. I've actually been thinking about writing an article on it, so I guess this is a good chance for me to kind of give my thoughts. So I got to say, too, I don't have a huge base of experience in the sense that I only went to two schools for exercise science-based stuff. I mean, fine programs, but to be completely honest, I can count on one hand the things that I learned from those schools that I would actually use. My goal was generally speaking to get a B, and then I did a lot of reading on my own, tons of reading through forum threads. I'd print out hundreds of pages of various weightlifting manuals and all these things. I read Super Training and was underlining stuff when I was in college. I mean, I didn't care a lot about stuff that other people thought, you know, would say I would know, unless it was something that really interested in me, like kinesiology, learning the muscles and their functions and those types of things. But man, a lot of the other classes, I was just like, I'm just going to get a B and then learn the stuff I want to learn. Oh, it sounds bad. Doing my thesis was kind of cool. Anyway, sorry, I'm totally sidetracking here, but I think it's not just an exercise science thing. It's a college in general thing. I think that there's a lot of college graduates who do not graduate college with a skill. I think that, and one of the things I've almost tried to think of is, and I like Cal Newport's book, Deep Work, but like the idea that you have a skill, like something that someone couldn't just learn in like three, if they had all the books and all your lifetime secrets that they couldn't just read in 3 months and have down pat, like knowing that you have a skill that has taken many years of dedicated practice to acquire. And I like to think of what I do on those terms. And I mean, strength and conditioning is a young practice. Sports performance, it hasn't been around as long as a lot of these other professions. And obviously it took a lot of professions quite a while to get going, especially say medicine, where you were probably better off not going to a doctor until the 1900s. but I digress a little bit. All right. So how do we bridge this gap? There's a lot of ways, I guess. The biggest thing I think, and you'll hear this, you do hear this, and people did preach the importance of internships when I was in college, but I just blew it off because I was like, okay. Like it didn't make sense to me. But we are, and I hear this from a lot of my guests, is we are an apprenticeship-based field. If you want to be good at this, you need to be mentored. And I think you have to find a good mentor. That's actually something I've kind of been a journeyman of sorts. I haven't had one person that has really, truly mentored me. I've kind of learned my way from a lot of different coaches, which is kind of probably not a good thing. But anyways, really, it would be getting young coaches in with a good mentor in from square one. Do you want to be a performance coach, a strength coach, a track coach? From the second that you get into that major, you need to be spending time, practical time, not just not just having a towel and wiping down the weight room or whatever, but practical time doing programming and getting that programming critically assessed. I think that's one of the biggest gaps, actually. And it's easy to learn exercises. Anybody can learn to teach someone a squat or a clean or coach it in minutes. Maybe not a clean in minutes, but I mean, to be okay enough at it and to learn the basic positions, that stuff's not complicated, especially if you're a gym rat and you like doing that stuff. Or you're a track athlete, you've been doing that stuff for your life, or whatever your profession, whatever your coaching muse is going to be. You've probably been doing that stuff. And so when someone says, here's the points, here's how you coach it. Cool. Wow. That was easy. So I went to school for 6 years to be able to say 10 things to an athlete. Right. But no, like learning how to program and critically think from square one, I think is one of the most important things, that a young coach can do, because I think that's a really important skill. Learning to coach from square one, learning what to say, learning what not to say, learning how to kind of tell what individual athletes need, different types of athletes, the art of coaching. You're never going to get that in a textbook, and we don't often quantify it when we coach. So that's something I've always kind of been mindful of sharing with the interns who cross my path, is how to kind of how to talk to and how to coach and work with different athletes, different groups of teams, kind of what makes people tick. So the art of coaching from square one, the art of programming from square one. And I'll tell you what I think would be awesome for college. Just I'll leave it with this. And I've thought about this a lot. And I think this, I mentioned the skill thing, is I feel like if you're going to go into coaching, at least sports performance, maybe not so much team sport or not team sport, but I think you should get a massage therapy license as part of your undergraduate degree. Because, well, one, you're going to learn anatomy really, really well. Two, you're going to be licensed to put your hands on people, so you can do more than, and not that I'm not discrediting people who don't have a massage therapy license, but you can do a lot more with athletes if you can do manual adjustments and various things, get in the tissue. And three, well, you have a skill. You graduated your 4-year university that you paid $100,000 for, or whatever, or probably more these days. And you have an actual skill that does distinguish you from other people, that distinguishes you for someone who paid $200 for a certification that says they're a strength coach. You have something that did take some time and that took a certain amount of hours to get better at. So I think that would be cool. So apprenticeships, manual therapy, all square one. I think that stuff is really important, because it's really easy. College is just to get your foot in the door, but it doesn't mean you learned anything. So that's my take on that. Hopefully it didn't, I don't know, upset too many people, but oh well. Okay.
You're listening to the Just Fly Performance Podcast, brought to you by Simply Faster.
Let's see, next question. They're strong by science, and kind of part two here, and see how we're doing on time. I think this will be the last one. I'm going to save the other ones for next time. All really, really amazing questions, and I appreciate you all for asking them. And that's, if there was one resource that you wish existed, what would it be? This is a multi-part question. Well, I'll try to get all these then. So one resource I wish existed, to be honest, maybe it's a dream, but I wish there was almost like a common, and I've thought about doing this for the site, but basically a place that you could go and you could see other coaches' programs, the nuts and bolts, the stuff that people don't often aren't as likely to talk about. People like to talk about theory, but then it comes time to say, hey, what did your program look like? What were the results you got? What was different for this athlete versus that athlete? This is the stuff that's the art of what we do. It's not something you learn in a textbook, and it's something that you only learn by experience and talking to other coaches and trying it yourself. And I wish there was a resource where there was programming and the results we got for individual athletes and notes as to why and the how, and a place that all of us coaches could kind of put our programs up and say, hey, you can look at it, you can critique it. Maybe I'll check out your program, see what you did with this athlete. Wow, that's awesome, cool. And I think that would just give a lot of clarity in the profession for a lot of things. I think it's, and it, a track especially, if someone trains an athlete that is just ridiculous, like especially kind of a one-off, you're like, oh, what was their program? But it takes, I'd like to look at the programming of coaches who are repeatedly churning out good athletes. I think that says a lot, and we learn a lot by it. And And so programming results, it comes down to that a lot. It's easy to talk about theory. I know I do a lot, but I'd like to think that I'm at least somewhat transparent in some of the methods and means that I've done. And I know too, and I do this as well, as a lot of us have to make a profit and things. And so there, a lot of times the nuts and bolts do come with a little bit of a price tag, and I think that's fine. But I also think that from a coach to coach perspective, just talking and be a place to sit down and exchange ideas and in the form of programming, that'd be cool. Okay. If you could meet your younger self, what book would you advise him to read? That would be good. I'm going to kind of cheat. I'm not going to just pick one. I'm going to go with two. And just to be safe, I'm giving a book to my younger self. I want to make sure that I want to give myself a little bit of a safety net by giving two. You know, maybe the one was going to give the wrong message. I don't know. Or maybe one was too much for me at the time. But the two I'm going to go with, one's going to be The Warrior Within by Bruce Lee. Loved reading that book. I read it about 3 years ago. And one of the things that I really got out of that is, like, as an upcoming coach, is the idea of Bruce Lee wasn't famous because of his exercises. he was famous because of the philosophy that he had behind everything he did. And the longer I've been coaching, the more I realize the importance of cultivating the why of what you do. And not only the why in terms of mechanical exercise stuff or periodization, but also just relating to the athletes and the human side of coaching, and why being a coach in the community, and why are we doing this in the first place? And the more I've just read out of the general world of things, just psychology and business and personal development and all that has really made a meaningful impact on my coaching and what I do. So I think by reading that book earlier, I think it would have helped me with developing that and the importance of developing those things and the why of and the essence behind it from a younger age. I think it would have been cool. And the second would be So Good They Can't Ignore You by Cal Newport. And it just I go back to the skills thing. I think that I hope reading that book wouldn't have turned me away from coaching. I guess it might have been a little risk to give myself that. I mean, like, oh, there's more opportunity somewhere else. I'm going to go there. And I there's nothing wrong with chasing opportunity. But the idea that of building skills, not taking for granted that you are in this field and that you want to have skills in this field that you know have taken you years of experience. And for me, to me right now, that means that I'm continually going to seminars and even through running this podcast, being able to talk to experts in the field and being able to see and work with athletes in a new way that took me years of experience to get there, and knowing that I have a skill, that this is a skill, that my coaching is a skill, that my program writing is a skill, that the way I analyze an individual athlete is a skill, and continually building and improving on those is really important to me. And I think that I mean, the idea of following your passion is certainly interesting. I like to think of what I do now. It's something I love. I really enjoy going to work every day, doing what I do every day, writing. But I always want to keep things in perspective and want to think about how to continually get better in a way that's meaningful and offers value to society. So I would have given myself those two books. I think they would have helped me out early, and I'm happy where I am, to be honest. I don't know if I go back in my past that I would necessarily change anything. I don't think I was a very effective coach or just person in terms of really. I don't think I really got on that train until I started Just Fly Sports. But I'm happy where I'm at. So, but I would have given myself those two books. Anyways, that's it for the questions for today, or the answers for today. Thanks for sending them my way. I really appreciate it. All right. Thanks for joining us today. Really appreciate you taking the time. As I already mentioned, please don't forget to visit our sponsor that makes this possible, simplyfaster.com, suppliers of high-end training technology, K-Box, Gymaware, SpeedMat, RunScribe, PowerDot. You want it to improve your sports performance, tracking, quantification of training means. They are your answer. So check them out. They have amazing products, great customer service, and an incredible blog. simplyfaster.com. Okay, we will see you guys again next week. And also, I didn't get to about half the questions, so I will most definitely make time to do another episode like this where I finish them off. Again, it was a little bit long-winded, and I apologize for that, although I hope I was able to thoroughly answer those of you questions who I did get to. So we'll see you guys again next week. Have a great one.